right, I will call this hearing of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. Today is February 9th, 2023. A quorum is present, so we'll go ahead and get started with the minutes. Let's see. Do we have a motion to approve the minutes of February 7th, 2023? Representative Johnson moves the minutes of February 7th, 2023. Any discussion for the minutes? All right, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. First bill on our agenda today, Representative Pinto, if you want to come on up. He made it in time.
I did, just barely.
We're in a different hearing room than we usually are, so it takes a little longer to walk over here. So I will move to re-refer House File 14 to the Committee on Ways and Means. Representative Pinto, I understand you have an A6 amendment. Would you like to explain the amendment, or should we go to Mr. Diebel?
If we could have Mr. Diebel do so, that'd be great. Thank you. And I might actually ask a page if there's the packet the committee members have for the bill. That'd be helpful because I actually realized I didn't have that with me. So thank you so much. But yeah, if Mr. Diebel could do that, that'd be great.
Can you
put the mic closer? Okay, there we go. Oh, thank you.
Acoustics are a little different in this room compared to our dark rooms over in the SOB. Mr. Diebel, if you could explain the A6.
Madam Chair and members, the A6 amendment is a technical amendment to make a conforming change based on an amendment that was adopted in public safety, which extended the period for which the chief law enforcement officer has to process a report of transfer from 5 to 30 days, and there was a cross-reference to a 5-day that was not included in the original amendment.
That sounds like a technical amendment. All those in favor of the A6, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The amendment, the motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Thank you, Mr. Diebel. With that, Representative Pinto, we will go to you to tell us about House File 14 as amended.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, and thanks, members. House File 14 is a bill to require criminal background checks on all gun sales in Minnesota with a number of exceptions, as are listed at the back end of the bill. This is a bill that has been considered by the House and actually advanced by the House previously, but blocked in the final negotiations with the other chamber. Members, you're, I think, well aware that our country has a significantly higher rate of gun deaths than other countries around the world, any country we wish to compare ourselves to, and even many countries we probably wouldn't want to. And members, criminal background checks are in use all around the country. They're keeping the residents of those states safer. And our state, again, has criminal background checks on many gun sales, but there's a significant chunk, those done not by dealers, but by private sellers, for which background checks do not apply. There's some mechanics on the bill in terms of how that works. And maybe I should just note that that what happens is that a buyer would need to present a permit to purchase, which they could obtain by going to law enforcement, having a background check done, receiving that permit, then showing it to the seller and the buyer keep the records, and then assuming that everything is fine, then the transaction happens, a permit to carry qualifies as permit to purchase. If they don't wish to keep those documents, keep the materials, then there's an option in the bill to go to a dealer, federal firearms licensee, and to complete the transaction there. So there's a lot of options, and there's tremendous support for the bill, and perhaps we should just move to that, Madam Chair, at this point, and hear about some of that support and then concerns from other folks as well.
Great. We do have several people signed up to testify today. First, I have Commissioner Paul Schnell. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Paul Schnell, Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Corrections, here today to speak in support of House File 14. In my life, prior to serving as Commissioner, I was a police officer for 27 years and a police chief for 9 of those years. And I've had the opportunity as a police chief to testify before this committee many times. With regard to proposals related to common sense gun laws. And my support for this proposal remains steadfast. I want to first acknowledge that we know that any strategy to address the lethal intersection between guns and issues like mental illness should focus on a variety of factors. And we recognize that the vast majority of people with mental health problems will never engage in violence, first and foremost, and that mental health concerns such as depression are strongly implicated in issues of suicide, which we know accounts for more than half of all gun fatalities annually. We know also that many people do go about the process of purchasing guns through licensed dealers, but we also know that many transfers occur through private sales that are not regulated, and there is no background check, and that is a fundamental and core concern. And having served as a police chief and being in the position of responding to a helpless family who only after a tragedy when their son took their life after purchasing a gun from a private party without any level of background check, that would have been stopped had a background check or the permit process occurred, is important. And I've heard all the arguments that if it wasn't a gun, that person could have used something else. And that may be true enough, but it was not the circumstance in this case. And I can tell you without equivocation that such a response would mean very little to that family whose son took their life while using that gun he purchased through a private party transfer. Providing this tool simply makes sense. It provides levels of mechanisms for due process, and I urge you to support House File 14. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on the list, I have Jeff Potts. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thanks, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jeff Potts. I'm the former Chief of Police for the City of Bloomington, but former Executive Director for the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. I'm here today speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, who represents more than 300 police chiefs across the state and over 200 command staff officers also across the state. I'm here today to testify in support of House File 14. The Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, along with many Minnesotans, support criminal background check legislation. While we know that this won't prevent all gun violence or all gun deaths, we do believe that this will make a difference, as we've seen this occur in other states who have this legislation. Current law here in Minnesota has a loophole that allows handgun and semi-automatic military assault rifle sales at private transactions, some gun shows, and other private transactions and private transfers that occur online to happen without a criminal background check, while all of the other sales of these particular firearms do require a background check. We feel strongly that requiring the criminal background check on all of these sales and transfers will prevent at least some of those firearms from going to individuals who are not legally allowed to possess them. We want to thank Representative Pinto for your continued support as we've worked with you on this issue for many years and your hard work to make this important public safety issue come to law here in Minnesota. Madam Chair and members, thank you for allowing me to testify here today.
Thank you for your testimony. Moving on to public testimony, I have Rob Doerr on the list and then Troy Olson on deck. Mr. Doerr, please introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am Rob Doerr. I'm the Vice President of the Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus. I think we've been down this road before, but we keep hearing about sales. One thing I want to point out is this is not just about sales. This is also about transfers. It's very common for gun owners to loan firearms amongst each other for purposes for hunting trips. Those hunting trips may take several weeks, going out of state, things like that. Under this bill, now 30 days would have to, an individual would have to go get a permit to purchase, wait up to 30 days, and in many cases beyond that, based on the behavior of some police chiefs who have routinely waited weeks or months beyond the current statutory limitations, to get a private transfer, get the permit to purchase to engage in that private transfer, keep that documentation for 20 years, And then when it's time to get my firearm back that I loaned out to my friend Representative Scott, for example, for her hunting trip, I can't just take possession of my firearm back again. Now I have to get the permit to purchase and wait the 30 days and get, you know, and keep that paperwork for 20 years. We do have the option of going to a federally licensed dealer, but that there is no guarantee that that option is going to be available in our area. FFLs are not obligated to provide that service, and they may charge a rather hefty $150, $200 charge to engage in that transfer. All of this being said, that the only, according to data from the Bureau of Justice Statistics, only 8% of criminally acquired firearms come from private sales. And a lot of those sales are from family members who would likely be exempted by this bill. We're missing the target here, going after the criminal acquisition of firearms, overwhelmingly the black market, straw purchasers, things like that, where I think we can build a lot of bipartisan support to go after, rather than adding additional hurdles for law-abiding gun owners to jump through that criminals will continuously just walk around. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I will say, I'm curious what Representative Scott is hunting with, a pistol or military style.
Madam Chair, wabbits.
Good to know.
I'll show you my 300
black on that. Yeah, all right. Representative.
Madam Chair, you can hunt grizzlies with a handgun.
Yeah, okay. We're reeling it in. You still got to talk through the chair. All right. Mr. Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. I'm Troy Olson, testifying in opposition to House File 14 on behalf of the National Shooting Sports Foundation. National Shooting Sports Foundation is a firearm industry trade association, which, with a membership of approximately 10,000 companies across the nation, employing over 11,500 Minnesotans, and having an economic impact of over $2.7 billion right here in Minnesota, according to 2021 numbers. NSSF opposes House File 14 because it is impossible to enforce without a national registration of all firearms and private party transfers. Of course, there is no national registry, and NSSF would strongly oppose any such scheme. NSSF has worked for years to keep firearms out of the hands of those prohibited from possessing them. NSSF supports legislation in states across the country to ensure that states submit all appropriate records into the NICS background check system. Too many laws that are already on the books are not being prosecuted or enforced, and HF 14 will only burden law-abiding gun owners and be ignored by those intent on doing harm. So NSSF opposes House File 14.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have a virtual testifier. We have Brian Gosch. All right, please proceed.
Yes, good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brian Gosch. I'm a lawyer and registered lobbyist with the National Rifle Association of America. We have a few issues with this bill. House File 14 sets up new ways for law enforcement to deny a transferee permit. It essentially attempts to incorporate a red flag standard into a denial of a transferee permit based on what a law enforcement agent perceives as an individual's risk to themselves or others, and that's without due process. Even worse is that the denial can potentially be indefinite. This bill makes it difficult to loan a firearm to many types of relatives and friends. And Minnesota has a strong tradition of hunting, and it is common to introduce people into the sport by loaning firearms for hunting purposes. House File 14 requires an onerous process before one could loan such a firearm for that purpose. House File 14 also adds a requirement for recording serial numbers and other firearm identification information upon each transfer. This sets up a form of government firearm registration, we believe. And additionally, it sets up unreasonable requirements for retention of paperwork and unreasonable criminal penalties for violations. So for these reasons and others, we would ask you to oppose House File 14. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. That concludes folks who had signed up ahead of time. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right. With that, we'll move on to member discussion. One question I did have, because I know there have been some slightly different versions of the bill over the years. Representative Pinto, could you just go over quickly the exceptions that are on pages 14 and 15?
I'm very glad to do so, Madam Chair. And I should note, you identify just one exception just to start, is this does only apply to pistols and then to a term that is in defined in law called semi-automatic military-style assault weapons, or SAMSAWs. So just to, that's one exception. But yeah, if members can turn, members of the public, to page 14, pages 14 and 15 list a number of transfers, because it is the case that it is not just an exchange of money for the firearm. A transfer does, the bill does apply, but you'll see that there are many, 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 many exceptions. And so between immediate family members, you'll see on lines 14.20, there is transfers while hunting, shooting range. I know at one point there was concerns from folks participating in high school competitions, and you'll see lawfully on page 15, line 15.13, lawfully organized competition, and then just a number of exceptions there. And I really would urge members to keep their eyes on that and keep this in mind over the course of the discussion and the vote. Thanks.
Thank you for that clarification. First on the list, I have Representative Grossel.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Pinto, you know, I know you've done a lot of work on human trafficking, sex trafficking, okay? And in that, in the working of that bill and transforming that statute, do you put any more restrictions on law-abiding citizens in that work?
Representative Grossel, I will... I'll allow Representative Pinto to respond, but I'll just remind everybody, actually, that the reason this bill is in this committee is some provisions that are in Section 1 regarding appeals process and court findings, so we're not going to get into the weeds in some bill that was passed a long time ago, but Representative Pinto, I'll allow it for now.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Thanks, Representative Grossel. I guess maybe the way to think about this, Representative Grossel, is that responsible gun owners, when I've had conversation with them, they would not hand their gun over to somebody where they don't know what that person's criminal record is. So they wouldn't hand their gun to somebody who might be possibly a violent felon, right? What this does is it holds all gun owners to that same level of responsibility. So when you talk about imposing, you say, on law-abiding people, well, what we're doing is we're saying that the expectation here, if this passes, is that all gun owners will have to comply with the standards that responsible gun owners set for themselves. And that's why this has the support of our police chiefs, as we heard, of our state sheriffs, county attorneys, and also our police, frontline police officers in the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association. So hopefully that's helpful to you.
All right. Follow-up, Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's, when I'm looking at this, you know, only 8% of guns purchased from friends or family, and these are exempt anyway, were used in commission of crime or other suicide or something like that. 6.5% were barred from a family, friend. Loans of less than 24 hours exempt again in this legislation. So some of the things that were described by our testifiers, this isn't going to make a difference. This isn't going to make a difference to save a life. I guarantee you that. We've had the Commissioner of Public Safety come in and talk to us about the massive increase of over 100% increase in computer crimes against children, tips. So are we going to now make people who go out to buy computers do all this kind of registration and stuff? This is exactly what you're doing here. You're telling people that I want to put more restrictions on you who aren't committing crimes, and not go after the problem itself, not go after the criminals themselves. And that's what I'm seeing here with these bills, that you guys do good work. And I'm working with Chair Moeller on some of the crim sec stuff too. You're going the opposite direction of what you have done in the past and what we're currently working on.
Representative Grossel, we're going to speak to the language of the bill.
I'll speak to the language of the bill, Madam Speaker. It's messed up. I'm sorry. You're not going after the people that you should be going after here. What you're doing is you're putting more burden on people like me, people like the chair, who are responsible gun owners. We're not going to hand it over to somebody who we know is not, who's not allowed to have a firearm. So unless we're going to go after computer sales, unless we're going to go after, because in my area where I worked in law enforcement, a baseball bat was a weapon of choice. So you're going to make every little league coach have registration for baseball bats? Make them have registration for computers because they're going to commit crimes against children? You do good work. You do good work, Representative Pinto, on other things. Let's not mess that track record up with this.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Grosso, when you're using the word "you" too much, you're starting to get into the motives land, and we're not going to go there. Representative Pinto.
Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair. Maybe I'll just say one thing, Representative Grosso, that I definitely heard you say that I think is so important is that responsible gun owners behave in this way. Responsible gun owners do not hand their weapons over. And so what we're trying to do, without ensuring that the person receiving is eligible, what we're trying to do here is to hold all gun owners to that standard. And I think that's something that I would hope we all could agree that it is critical for the safety of all of us that we hold all gun owners to the standard of responsible gun owners. So gun owners apparently like yourself, and you alluded to the chair, and I suspect that she'd agree with that. So thank you, Representative Grosso. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Yep, and I will say when I've purchased firearms from Joe's Sporting Goods, the background process has not been onerous whatsoever. It might have caused me to buy some more stuff in the 5 minutes while I was wandering around the store, but not too much of a burden at all. Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. And I just wanted to speak to some statistics that we've heard a few times already this morning. There's been that low number of 8% thrown out. And I just want to remind folks that I believe that number is used intentionally, because if we actually look at the number of gun deaths in the United States, that is 45,000 plus people per year. 8% of 45,000 people is 3,600 people who are involved in gun deaths. So if we're looking at statistics and we're saying it's only 8% of gun-related crimes that are committed by people not going through this process legally, and that we shouldn't pursue legislation to correct that 8%, I challenge folks to find a way to justify 3,600 deaths that could have been prevented by this. Thank you.
Thank you. Next on the list I have Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Finn, Representative Pinto, I understand why you want to do this. Restricting access to a Second Amendment, constitutional amendment, to the vast number of citizens and making it a lot of hurdles in order to exercise their Second Amendment rights. I'm disappointed that this bill is moving forward again. Just want to go through a couple of things that were stated earlier by some other individuals. They talked about gun shows. 0.6% of all firearm sales come from gun shows. And the people that are at the gun shows, if you're regularly going to gun shows as a person selling firearms, guess what? You have to have your FFL and you have to go through the NICS check and background checks just like any other dealer. Very few people selling the actual firearms at the gun shows are not dealers. I'm also was interested. I've been unfortunately had the in my career in law enforcement had the unfortunate situation where I had to go to a lot of suicides. A number of them with firearms, and I do not recall one of them where they went out and purchased that firearm within the last month to do the suicide. The firearm had been purchased by them years ago, or with their, so it's not a situation where they go purchase the firearm to commit suicide. I'm disappointed that our law enforcement partners that are here today that made those comments, I have a feeling it's been a long time since they've been on the road, because that's not what happens. It may happen occasionally, but not very often. And then I want to, would like to talk about the military-style semi-automatic rifle, better known as the AR-15 or the Armalite rifle, Model 15, which is the most common one out there. When that first came out, the military personnel in Vietnam didn't want to use it. They called it a G.I. Joe gun or a Tonka toy because it was made of plastic. But they learned how to use it, and a lot of them, it was the first rifle or firearm they ever learned to use. That's what they were comfortable with. That's why they became popular. Because they hadn't used the old Woodstock firearms when they were growing up. They were taught with the AR-style rifle. When you're taught to use something, that's what you usually use your whole life. I grew up in a family that only drove Fords. We don't drive Chevys. Guess what? I drive Fords. Just because that's the way we grew up. It's the same way with the firearms that people like to choose. It's the one they're comfortable using. And there is no difference between a military-style assault rifle. A good example of that is the Ruger 10/22. You can buy it with a Woodstock, or you can buy it with all the cosmetics that looks just like an AR-15, but it's the same rifle. No difference. The only reason this was put into law is because the AR-style rifle looks scary. Now, Representative Pinto, I do have a question for you and a couple comments afterwards. In this bill, it allows the police chiefs and the sheriffs to wait 30 days instead of the 5 days that, or 7 days, I believe it's 7 days that they have to get the permit to acquire back, which is good for 1 year. Do we need to tweak something on that so if somebody violates or does something that permit is revoked? Absolutely. I agree with you on that part. But if they haven't violated...
Representative Johnson, was there a question? I don't want you to go to your comments before he has a chance to answer the question.
I'm about to ask the question.
Okay, it wasn't clear.
But my concern is, in your transfer, part of it you talk about if the police chief feels there's situations where the person might... commit suicide or something like that, they can deny the transfer. Can you tell me anywhere in the Constitution or the state laws that allows an unelected police chief or an elected sheriff to restrict the constitutional rights or remove them from an individual of the state without a judge's approval?
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, Representative Johnson. I'm trying to sort of get my head around your question. So the Supreme Court case, Heller, that articulated the individual Second Amendment right, Justice Scalia is really explicit in there that says that this is not intended to cast any kind of doubt on restrictions on and I think the phrase in there is the commercial sale of firearms. What this is saying that that if somebody displays, and I don't have the, bring up the exact language here, but the, a substantial likelihood of danger to self or others, there's a lot of details on that. I guess I would, if your question is, do I foresee constitutional problems with this under current Supreme Court jurisprudence, I certainly don't. There's a ton of process here. I will note that if there is a denial of an application, the burden is on the government, is not on the applicant, to prove that, in fact, the denial was appropriate. So, no, Representative Johnson, I think we're on very solid constitutional ground.
Quick follow-up, Representative Johnson. I do have several other members on the list, and I want to make sure our testifiers all can get in on the next bill. So, Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Finn, I agree we should allow the testifiers to all weigh in, but also we need to fully vet this bill, even though we've done it numerous years in a row. yet there's always changes.
There's only two bills on the agenda. We're all getting a chance to speak, but we've got it. We can't be here forever. So just if you could get to your point, that would be great so we can get to some of your colleagues.
Chair Beckerton, Representative Pinot, it's my understanding right now we have what's called a 72-hour hold if somebody's in crisis. And that hold for law enforcement, we can't restrict their rights, is only to get them in that door for an evaluation. It doesn't mean that they're going to stay there for 72 hours, but they have 72 hours to have a psychologist talk to them. And the psychologist makes the decision. If the psychologist says that, yes, there's enough to hold on to because they have some problems, they only can hold on to them for that 72-hour period, and they have to go to the judge to have their rights restricted to continue in the program. This bypasses that whole thing without going to a judge to have somebody's Second Amendment rights restricted. So with that, I'll end there, Chair.
All right, thank you. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have a question and then just a couple of points to address some things that have been said. I mean, I've heard it said that this isn't going to save a life. And we already heard what Commissioner Schnell said, the example that he gave about a gun that was sold without a background check at a gun show. We also heard examples of this in the Public Safety Committee. We heard from a woman whose aunt was killed because a gun was purchased at a gun show. That actually happened in the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. In the Hennepin County Courthouse, where I work, and after that, they ended up increasing security. But that gun was also purchased because of this loophole in the law. We've also heard about suicides and talk that this isn't going to impact suicides. Well, we have other bills also to address that issue. This is one of other bills. Excuse me, Madam Chair. We also heard that the SAMHSA prohibition, the semi-automatic military-style assault weapon, was enacted because those guns, quote, look scary. Those guns were used in mass killings in our country, including murdering our children in schools. I do have a question, Madam Chair, for Representative Pinto. The NRA lobbyists claim that this is creating a gun registry, and I don't see that in this bill, and if you could address that, please. Thank you.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Mueller. And I should say, what I heard the lobbyists to say is that this would be unenforceable without a gun registry. And I just don't know. I strongly disagree with that. So first of all, just to be clear, it does not create a registry. It doesn't require the buyer or seller to provide to send the records in or anything. There's a transaction. The records are kept. Again, unless they choose to take the option of going to the dealer. And then the enforceability is the way it is with a wide variety of crimes. Those records are held. If in fact there is evidence that a gun is used in a crime, then police may investigate them. They may at that point contact the owner, because they'll know that the owner of the gun, the person who sold the gun, purchased that firearm because their records kept by a dealer. But the records are not sent in by the buyer and the seller in this transaction. There is no gun registry at all here. It is in fact enforceable without one.
Thank you, Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Pinto. I wanted to ask a little bit about this new process that we're creating, giving quite a bit of discretion to chief law enforcement officers to restrict the issuance of transferee permits. And in particular, I wanted to hear your thoughts on the ACLU of Minnesota's letter as it relates to this, where they stated that when the state seeks to expand its authority to enter into people's homes and infringe on their rights, we have cautioned against well-intentioned policies that could be wielded by the state with discriminatory intent or impact, and we do so again today. I assume that you don't agree with that this is something that's going to have a disproportionate, discriminatory intent or impact, but I'm curious as to whether there's any mechanism under this law or how this interacts with current law that would help us to collect information or data about what the potential discriminatory impacts of this law would be.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, Representative Niska, for the question. So, yeah, I do disagree with the thrust of, I mean, I agree with those, with some of the principles that they state. I do disagree that they're implicated here. I guess I feel like connecting your question with Representative Moeller's, I mean, the problem is if we're collecting records, what I hear is the concern among gun owners about any sort of collecting of records. So what I'll note again is that the way this is set up is that there are a lot of due process protections provided to the applicant. If law enforcement does deny the application, the applicant not only has the right to appeal, but the burden is on the state at that point. So whenever we talk about kind of analyzing or reporting on information regarding guns, I feel like I hear from folks who express a lot of concerns about that. So that'd be my concern, I guess, in response to your question, is that I feel like especially some folks who are maybe allied with you would express concerns about that. But happy to talk about how to sort of understand that better.
Representative Niska.
Yeah, Madam. Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Pinto. And I think there are two different things in this when we're talking about collecting data or information. One would be obviously there's a concern that all of those who receive permits might be put into a database. My question is more about the folks who are denied permits and whether there is. So let's say, for example, that after 5 years, 95% of the individuals who have been denied permits are black men. Is there any way that we would know that? Is the BCA going to collect data about the denials of those folks, or are the courts going to collect that demographic information as it relates to appeals of those denials? Is there any way that we would actually be able to know if this law goes into effect, whether it has some kind of disparate impact? You know, that's just one possible way. That seems like an extreme example. I don't think it would turn out quite that way, but just as a hypothetical example, is there any way we would know whether the ACLU is right or whether you're right about the effect of this bill?
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Niska, thank you. And I appreciate the acknowledgement that our criminal legal system does have a really significantly disparate impact on especially Minnesotans of color. And so there's that concern. I will note again that I often hear that even the fact that someone was seeking to have a gun is sort of highly confidential and highly private, and there's these concerns about that, sort of how that works. I will say that I'm as you raise that regarding sort of reporting, I maybe have to think about that a little bit further, but I just know from having done this work over a number of years that anything regarding this when it comes to data collection reporting really raises a lot of hackles, a lot of concerns. I will note that the experience, I've also found that that gun owners are vocal in terms of expressing their views as well they should in our democracy. And I also, I guess, Representative Niska would expect that if this is operating in some way which is problematic, that folks will be speaking up. I will say, Representative Niska, that in the states around the country that have criminal background checks on all gun sales, which is many, many states, and it's working very well, there's no gun registry in those states, I mean, this works well, that in fact, you know, this has worked quite well in those states. That should be reassuring to you and the ACLU as well. Thanks.
Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to just go back to something that Representative Johnson was talking about and kind of when there are scenarios where law enforcement can infringe upon our constitutional rights. And I just wanted to make the point that that happens all the time. Our constitutional rights are not, they don't exist in a vacuum. They are not absolute. For example, free speech rights are restricted to reasonable time, place, and manner. Protesters who stop traffic on the highway, law enforcement can come and break up that constitutional right to assemble and free speech. And as Representative Pinto said, the Heller decision makes it clear that the Second Amendment, like all constitutional rights, is not absolute. And I just wanted to make that point. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn and Representative Pinto, for your bill. I just have a very quick question. These conversations often focus around a common phrase, which is responsible gun owners. So I just wanted to know if there are irresponsible gun owners in the state of Minnesota who recklessly transfer firearms that lead to deaths.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Finke, so I don't know specific situations, what the research would say in the states that have this is that having background checks results, those states have, lower rate of homicides, lower rate, I should note, especially domestic violence homicides is part of that. We know that not all gun owners in the state of Minnesota live up to the example of Representative Grossel and Chair Becker Finn. It is not the case that every gun owner ensures that before handing over their gun, that the person they give it to is in fact valid and legally able to receive it. And we know that background checks in other contexts where we have them have blocked many people who are in fact violent felons from having guns. So I have every confidence that, in fact, this will prevent a gun from changing hands to somebody who is, in fact, not allowed to have it and be used in a manner to hurt somebody.
Thank you. Representative Scott, and then we'll wrap up.
Madam Chair and members, I'm a little bit troubled because I feel like some of our members weren't able to finish their thoughts. I know Representative Niska had more questions and he was... you pivoted to another member.
Well, and Representative Scott, I do want to address that because it's so there's a choice. We have so many hours in the day, and I could have cut off many of these questions because they weren't actually to the reasons this was in front of our committee and the jurisdiction that we have. But I allowed that latitude so you could kind of get out the things that you needed to say. And so there's always going to be that push and pull. There's no intent to silence anyone. Almost everyone on your side has had a chance to speak. But that's always what we're doing. We're always weighing the things. I could cut off some of the testifiers. We could have fewer testifiers, but there just are really so many hours in the day. And I guess I will rein things in on the comments on the next bill to keep the jurisdiction really to what's in front of us and on both sides, if that's what needs to happen. But we're doing our best here, and there's no ill will. Representative Niska is welcome to talk to Representative Pinto offline as well, and we'll do our best. But Representative Scott.
Madam Chair, thank you. Committees are for vetting, and that's what we're elected to do. So I'll move on with my question. I just want to preface this by saying again that this is a constitutional issue. And any time that you're you just have to be very serious when you're trying to take away someone's constitutional rights. And I look at this bill and I see several things. I see there are many delays in issuing the permit. And some would say that a right delayed is a right denied. And so I feel like we're adding 30 days here and 20 days there. And the other concern that I have, Representative Pinto, is if a person is denied by a law enforcement, the head of a law enforcement department, and this person wants to take it to court, who pays the court costs?
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Scott. So the applicant at that point would pay, as the plaintiff, I believe that's the case, would pay to file the appeal, though the burden again is on the state in that when the court reviews the denial of the application.
Representative Scott.
Madam Chair, thank you. And Representative Pinto, I think that's correct. And yeah, the burden is on the state to prove it, but someone of low income may not be able to afford to go to court and defend their constitutional right. And that's a concern to me. That we talked about disparities already, and I do love your newfound trust of law enforcement when the left has repeatedly over the last few years undermined law enforcement. And now all of a sudden you're putting your trust in one law enforcement person, the head of a department, to make a decision like this, and then it may be too costly for that person to go into court and defend their constitutional right.
Madam Chair.
Keep and bear arms.
Yep. Representative Pinto, and I will say for folks who are familiar with the court process that if you cannot afford court filing fees, there is a process for folks to have that waived. And Representative Pinto.
And Madam Chair, I'm sorry, but I feel like that was actually, when you said the word you, I assume you meant my political party, but I took it also individually. I've worked as a prosecutor since, for a long time now, and I work very closely with law enforcement officers, and I will say that I was pretty personally insulted by the idea that that my trust in the law enforcement officers I work with every day is newfound. Representative Scott, we have a good relationship, and I think you probably intended that more broadly, but I took that, when you say you, I took that in an individual perspective and found that pretty frustrating. So.
And a reminder to everyone, and I wish everyone in our entire body would listen to this, but if you're speaking to why a person is doing something, then you are speaking to motives. So we're not going to go, that's against our rules, we're not going to go with that. So, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I did mean you broadly. You can mean one person or it can mean broadly, right? So I apologize, I did not mean to single you out. I want to address another issue that Representative Curran brought up, the 45,000 people that are killed annually by firearms. And I want to say that 75,000 are killed annually now by fentanyl. And we have a problem down at the border that the president of your party will not close the border.
Representative Scott, to the bill, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think part of the statistic that was cited by Representative Curran is it's important. Curran, I'm sorry. Thank you. It's important to point out that 8% of criminally acquired firearms are private sales, not 8% of gun deaths from private firearms. And you also included suicide deaths in there, so it wasn't exactly an apples-to-apples comparison and statistic that you saw.
Lots of random fruit comparisons happening this morning, Representative Scott.
Right, thank you. Madam Chair, I just think that this bill is giving too much power to one individual within government to deprive someone of their constitutional rights. And no one around this table believes that there shouldn't be some assessment and some way of determining someone's ability to and responsibility to own a firearm. We have a process that's in place, and there's a way of doing this without denying someone their constitutional right to come before a judge or a jury and prove that they are capable. I don't believe that this bill is going to solve violent crimes. I've had a bill, as you know, Representative Pinto, that would get at those that are legally transferring a firearm to a known felon. That's where most of these crimes are happening, with illegal guns, 67%. So I think this, again, has been stated, I'll state it again, this is going to put the onus on law-abiding gun owners and not really get at the criminal element, which is the problem with gun violence in our state. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Frazier, real quick, and then we're going to get to the vote.
Yeah, I'll be quick. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Pendle, thank you for bringing this bill. I think it's a common sense one. It's one of many tools that we're going to have to put in place to deal with the gun violence problem that we have, not only in our state but in our country. One of the things that I am very excited about is the conversation around and the passion that I heard from inquiries from my colleagues over here around the inequities in our system. And so I know bills are going to be coming for this committee, and I'm looking forward to them bringing that energy and passion to discussing both bills and passing them along. So thank you.
Right, Representative Pinto, closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, Representative Frazier, for that. Look, the fact is, members, criminal background checks work. That's why we have them on many gun sales. You ask Minnesotans, should there be a background check to make sure that somebody who has already been, we've already decided that some people should not have access to guns. Criminal background checks work. They're working in other states that are in there. And this is why this does have the support of law enforcement and the broad support of the vast majority of Minnesotans. Members, thanks for the conversation, and I'd urge your support. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, and didn't catch it on the record, but Representative Scott indicated that she would like to request a roll call. So roll call having been requested, I will renew my motion that House File 14, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker-Finn.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Aye.
Minority Lead Scott.
No.
Representative Carroll.
Aye.
Representative Curran.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Finke.
Aye.
Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Representative Grossel.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Niska.
No.
Representative Weems.
No.
It's 8 ayes, 5 nays.
All right, with 8 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to Ways and Means. Thank you, Representative Pinto. Vice Chair Frazier, we've got House File 15. Vice Chair Frazier, would you like to move that House File 15 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means?
Yes, Madam Chair, it is my motion.
All right. Vice Chair Frazier moves that House File 15 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. I understand there is an A6 amendment to this bill as well, as if you can explain the A6, please.
There is, Madam Chair, and I would, if I could, have staff do a quick walkthrough of what the amendment does.
Sure thing.
Madam Chair and members, the A6 amendment relates to a variety of provisions to the mental health piece of this. The first section, on beginning on 1.2, adds the definition of mental health professionals through a cross-reference to Chapter 245.I. Continuing with that, it authorizes mental health professionals to bring and file a petition for an ERPO, or Emergency Risk Protection Order. That would be extend the group of individuals who would be authorized to go to court and request that the emergency order be issued. Conforming change on 1.6 to 1.8, which is to allow the mental health professional to disclose health information about the respondent in the order, which would be a deviation from many restrictions under HIPAA. Several of the other changes were requested by mental health advocates to clarify the use of harm to self, to refer more to a significant risk of suicide, so explicitly identifying the risk of to the individual. And you'll see that quite a few of these are, again, conforming changes to represent that, and I believe we'll have a representative from the NAMI speaking to this provision. At the bottom of page one of the amendment would limit the access to orders that are issued based solely on a risk to a person's health or suicide to those who know it to be public. If the court determined that the sole grounds for the issuing the order was that there was a risk of suicide. On page two, these are again conforming changes to reflect the change in the wording to refer to suicide. And then the final two lines, one is a cross-reference to add mental health professionals to the exception for liability if they choose not elect to make their professional judgment not to file an ERPO, they cannot be sued. And on the final line, it would require that the post board consult with NAMI when developing the policy for implementing the ERPO process for peace officers.
Thank you. Any discussion to the A6? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the bill's author, I had a couple of questions. Does this transfer of mental health information, does that include patient communication with that mental health person?
Vice Chair Frazier.
I would suspect that it will only include information that's necessary and needed to provide to give information to the arbiter, which would be the judge, to make a determination about whether or not this individual would, in fact, are in danger of harming himself or suicidal issues.
Representative Scott.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And any concern at all that this might have a chilling effect on people actually going to a mental health professional and stating that they're having some issues? And that they need help. Any, you know, if they're afraid they're going to have a constitutional right revoked, by doing that, do you think this will have a chilling effect at all?
In my conversations with mental health professionals, that has not been the concern that it would have a chilling effect.
Representative Scott, and I do know too, you know, if there's a risk that someone discloses that they may harm somebody, there's already legally a way that mental health professionals are required to act on that. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I understand that, but this would be taking it a step further and putting a constitutional right at risk. I wonder on lines 1.18, if there's a definition somewhere in statute, and maybe this is a question for House Research, is there a definition for serious mental illness?
Research? I don't think that there is in statute. I know for mental health professionals, you know, serious and persistent mental illness is a very common term that's used, but I guess we're unsure. Is what the research corner is telling me. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would really like to see that defined or some examples of what a serious mental illness is versus a non-serious mental illness when it comes to depriving someone of their Second Amendment rights. Thank you.
All right. Any further discussion to the A6? All right. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Moving on to the underlying bill, Vice Chair Frazier, please tell us about your bill, and then we're going to keep to a strict 90 seconds on our testifiers. Vice Chair Frazier.
I will try to be brief so that we can make sure testifiers get in. Just quickly, this again is another tool. During the last discussion, we heard specific comments about how that bill would not stop suicides. Well, we know in the state of Minnesota, 76% of gun deaths are suicides by firearms. We have 351 people in Minnesota die by gun suicides, and 47 are wounded by gun suicide attempts a year. This bill will go a long way in helping to decrease those numbers. And what we also know by data in some of the other states that have implemented bills similar to this, we have seen an effective impact of there has been a decrease and suicide by firearms. There's also been situations, and we've had, I've read interviews and comments from law enforcement in those states where they have actually intervened and stopped potential mass shootings as well due to these laws being in effect. They have often described it as a cooling off period. It's a temporary situation where you're removing an item that could cause mass harm or death. It's a cooling off period that allows for due process when you're making these allegations, and it has been shown to be an impactful and effective tool in the states that are using it. And I am looking forward to the conversation we're going to have here, and I'm looking forward to getting this implemented in the state of Minnesota to decrease the number of suicides and decrease the number of deaths by firearms. So with that, I'll yield for testifiers.
All right. We got Commissioner Paul Schnell and then Jeff Potts on deck. If the person on deck could move up to one of these chairs to move things along, that'd be great. Commissioner Schnell, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning once again, Madam Chair. Paul Schnell, Commissioner of Corrections, and I'm here today to speak as a cabinet member of the Walls File Hannigan administration in support of Pulse File 15. While it's been 4 years since I worked as an active law enforcement officer, I regard the extreme risk protection order proposal as a measured, fair, and balanced approach to addressing the articulable danger posed by firearm access, especially when it's reported by and assessed by people who best know the dangers that may exist. Just months before being appointed in 2019, I had the honor of serving as police chief in Invergrove Heights. On one evening, and as time would permit, I would respond to calls for service with the incredible officers who served that city. On this particular night, we responded to a call from a wife whose husband was experiencing a true mental health crisis, exacerbated by worsening alcohol abuse, likely to douse his depressive pain. I and other officers responded and met the man's wife and daughter at a neighbor's home. The wife reported that when she went to check on her husband that evening, she found him highly intoxicated in the garage, carrying a handgun and threatening to shoot himself. She told us that her husband was becoming increasingly despondent. She said this was not the first time he had threatened to take his own life, but it was the first time he had taken out a firearm, loaded it, and pointed at himself. The man's wife said she was going to call for help, and he told her that if the police or the paramedics called, he would shoot them and take his own life. Out of fear for what was going to happen, she got her daughter out of the house, called 911. The wife shared with us that her husband owned many guns, and before officers set about the task of safely trying to de-escalate the situation, the woman told officers to keep themselves and her husband safe. After about an hour of conversation, the man came out and was taken to the hospital for an assessment. He was released the following day after committing to abide by a safety plan, further assessment, and treatment. 48 hours later, officers were back at the home when the wife and daughter again fled. This time, the husband, again in crisis, intoxicated, angrily roamed the house, telling his wife and daughter that he would never allow them to have him taken away again. They said they were unsure what was about to happen. They again left the home. Officers responded and convinced the man to go to the hospital. He returned from the hospital again later the following day. But before that, they had called the police department and asked for all the guns from his home be removed out of care or concern for the fact that he would take his own life or others. But no mechanism existed to allow that to happen. The next time officers were called to the home about a week later, again, the man in crisis standing in his garage, this time threatened neighbors next door by pointing a gun at them. He was arrested and charged. And the ability to access the extreme violence protection order could have helped this man's wife and daughter. It could have, in this instance, helped this struggling man avoid a criminal conviction. And there's no doubt that if this would have persisted, that ultimately this would have ended in tragedy. But a tool did not exist. This bill provides a clear, well-established, and robust due process mechanism. Let's provide this tool to families and law enforcement and mental health providers. It makes sense. We urge your support of House File 15.
Thank you, Commissioner Snell. Jeff Potts and then Kentrell Galloway on deck.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Jeff Potts. I won't bore you with it all again, but the police chief from Bloomington, about a year and a half ago now, the executive director of the Minnesota Chiefs Association. To try to respect the chair's time restraints here of 90 seconds, I could tell you stories similar to what Commissioner Schnell just told you in my 12 years as a police chief in the city of Bloomington. And currently as the executive director, I talk to police chiefs on a daily basis that could also recount stories like that. I'm here today to testify in support of House File 15 on behalf of the Minnesota Chiefs Association. Extreme risk protection orders focus on a relatively rare but yet far too often tragic circumstances where individuals' mental health issues escalate to dangerous behavior. These orders will allow law enforcement or family members to bring evidence to a judge to temporarily separate that person in crisis from firearms when there is a substantial evidence that they pose a significant danger to themselves or others by possessing a firearm. Family members and law enforcement are often the first to see the warning signs. We believe the issuance of a temporary extreme risk protection order will be or is a sensible and reasonable option to address these potentially dangerous situations. We stand in support of House File 15 and sincerely thank Representative Frazier for bringing this bill here today. Madam Chair, members, thank you for allowing me to testify here today.
Thank you very much. Kentrell Galloway and then Sue Abderholden on deck. Please introduce yourself and then go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Kentrell Galloway. I'm the director of the Next Step program. The Next Step program is a hospital-based violence intervention and prevention program based out of Hennepin Healthcare. We help survivors of gun violence. So we're supporting hospitals at North Memorial, Abbott Northwestern, and Children's Minnesota. The Next Step program is a hospital-based violence intervention and program. We are a trauma response team who helps families and the survivors of gun violence once they come into the emergency room. We have served over 1,000 people in our program, and in my opinion, that's too many folks. Sorry about that. We are available 24 hours a day for our survivors. I'm sorry, I'm just passionate about this and really choking up, but As I said, the impact of gun violence goes far beyond than just people being shot. It's affecting our community. It's affecting my community. It's a long-lasting, it changes people's lives forever. And our program, we are there, we meet people, we meet, we understand what happened to them. We're understanding what needs they need to reassimilate back in the community safely. Our job, after the physicians heal folks, we're there to heal them socially, emotionally, and mentally. And the worst part about my job is when I have to hear the doctors give a family the news that they will no longer have a loved one in their life. That is devastating news. That's a cry that I can tell you that will stay with me for the rest of my life. Not only on top of that news when the family gets that news, but then they start to deal with understanding that they won't have that person anymore, but also the cost that comes with that. I can tell you in the past 2 years, I have personally bought 10 coffins for children under the age of 10. That is devastating. That's why I support this amendment that Representative Frazier is bringing forward. I understand that one proposal will not end gun violence, but we have to start somewhere. And me personally, I don't want to buy any more coffins for young children. We have to do the preventative work so folks are getting help before they reach us in the hospital. So I implore our people in power to please, please be disruptors like we are. Let's end the cycle of violence. We need your help. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for your testimony, and thank you for your service to our community. Sue Abderholden, and then we'll go to some virtual testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Member Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. First, I want to thank Representative Frazier for working with us on the amendments to just make it clear we're really talking about risk of suicide. I think that that's really important. As was mentioned, we lose way too many people to suicide and especially to guns because they are, frankly, lethal. What we believe the red flag law basically does is help us do what's called means restriction. And that's where we restrict access to lethal means to prevent someone from taking their own life. Time is key to preventing suicide, to help them see that the crisis won't last, to connect them to someone who can help, which is why, again, limiting access is so important. And I want to say that what the research tells us is that when you take away one method, people don't necessarily go to another. So when we put up barriers on bridges and they find that they can't jump off a bridge, they don't go somewhere else. We take away access to a gun, it doesn't mean they'll find something else to take their life. Time is key. If we can defer someone for even 5 minutes, they can change their mind. And this is why this is so important. People have brought up, you know, we can use a 72-hour hold. I want to say that at that point, it's almost too late. We want to actually intervene when someone is seriously at risk of suicide. They are contemplating it. They're thinking about what the plan is, not until they have the gun in their hand. We've also seen, honestly, because of the change in the use of force language, that we've seen police overriding mental health professionals' decisions in the field that someone actually could be brought in on a 72-hour hold. We've also had situations where if the person is alone in the house with a gun and there's no one else there, that actually police will not intervene. It has happened over and over to us. So this is, again, an early intervention way to prevent suicides. And, again, thank you for working with us on the amendment, and we support this bill.
Right. Thank you so much for your testimony. Next, we've got some virtual testifiers. We're going to go to Representative Denise Stoneback over Zoom. Please go ahead.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Denise Stoneback. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of House File 15. I've worked to reduce gun violence through education and evidence-based policies for over a decade. I'm the founder of the National Extreme Risk Protection Order Working Group, founder and past president of the nonprofit People for a Safer Society, and I'm a former Illinois state representative. As a legislator, I passed a bill to strengthen Illinois' ERPO. Through my interactions with law enforcement, researchers, policymakers, and other experts, I've heard countless testimonials of the effectiveness of ERPOs. These laws are a critical intervention tool that saves lives by allowing people to act proactively, preventing a tragedy before it occurs. ERPA laws have prevented firearm homicides, mass shootings, domestic violence shootings, and hate crimes. But ERPOs are particularly effective in preventing firearm suicides, which account for the majority of gun deaths, roughly 3 in 5. On average, 65 people per day die from gun suicide. Sadly, American veterans are disproportionately impacted, accounting for 1 in 5 adult firearm suicides. Firearm suicide is impacting our youth. The firearm suicide rate among young people has increased faster than any other age group, and is at its highest rate in more than 20 years. With ERPO, family members can prevent youth from having easy access to guns when they are most at risk. Correlations between firearm suicide and gun ownership should be noted. A Stanford study found that owning a handgun associated with a dramatically elevated risk of suicide. Before the pandemic, the U.S. already had the highest private gun ownership rate of the world. During the pandemic, gun ownership grew significantly. Increases in rates of gun ownership and gun suicide underscore the urgent need for prevention. We can prevent gun suicide through ERPO. Research has shown that for every 10 to 20 firearms temporarily removed through ERPO, one suicide is prevented. States with ERPO laws have lower gun-related suicide rates. A 2018 study published in the Journal of Psychiatric Services found that Indiana's ERPO led to a 7.5 reduction in firearm suicides, and Connecticut's ERPO led to a 13.7% reduction. I urge the adoption of House File 15 to make this critical life-saving tool available to Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we'll go to public testimony. I've got Brian Gosch also testifying remotely.
Okay, can you hear me okay?
Yep, we can hear you. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brian Gosch again. Lawyer and registered lobbyist for the National Rifle Association. I want to correct the record real quick, because in the previous bill, it was stated that I said that could not be implemented without a registry. That's not what I said. What I said was because of all the paperwork required and the information that's required to be stored and the length of time, I said that's kind of an indirect government registry, and we don't support that. On House File 15, this bill confiscates firearms and no other items that the individual could use to inflict harm. And there's nothing in the bill about the respondent getting mental health treatment or even evaluated after the guns are confiscated. And once the firearms are confiscated, there's no obligation they be transported and stored properly or by the least restrictive means. For example, transferring to a friend or relative as allowed in other chapters of Minnesota statutes. For example, in 518B, these are domestic abuse statutes. If an ex parte order is granted in that case, the respondent gets a hearing faster than is allowed in House File 15, and the firearms are allowed to be transferred to a friend or relative. But House File 15 doesn't allow that. It sets up an onerous process, and they can be stored improperly, transported improperly, and there's no liability on the people who do that. Finally, we really believe the existing civil commitment statutes are sufficient to address those who are a danger to themselves or others, and they do a better job of it if they're properly funded, because then you remove the person from all dangerous objects and they get mental health treatment, and it happens instantaneously. It happens way faster than this, because you get that person out of what is ostensibly a dangerous situation to themselves or others and into a mental health professional. So thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you. Next up, I've got Rob Doerr and then Tom Evanstead on deck. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rob Doerr again, Vice President of the Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus. A couple years ago, I got a call from one of our members, and his question was, he's a veteran. His question was, do I lose my gun rights if I start getting mental health treatment? And I could have given him the simple answer and say, probably not. There are some VA provisions, but I wanted to dig a little bit deeper and started talking to him. And realized that he was going through some stuff. He had been divorced. He had recently lost one of his children to a drug overdose. And in talking to him, I said, you know, I'm happy to hang on to your guns for you for a while you work through this stuff. One of his biggest concerns was that if he went to go get mental health treatment, he was going to lose his gun rights. And that may seem like it's crazy. That may seem like that in itself is a mental illness to you people. But some people are just that passionate about their liberties, about their rights. They care about it that much. So rather than see him forego the treatment, which I really think that he needed, I worked with him to help find a way that he was secure from his firearms, but also getting the help that he needed. And that's really what we need to focus on. The premise of this bill is once the firearms are gone, everything's okay. They're no longer a risk to themselves or others. That is an entirely faulty premise, and I sit here ready and willing to work with anybody who wants to try to help the people who are suffering in these crises, rather than just think that because the guns are gone, everything's okay. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Tom Evanstead and then Elena Niehoff on deck.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Vice Chair Frazier, and lead, Minority Lead Scott. My name is Thomas Evanstead, and I am testifying in opposition to HF 15, the so-called red flag law. I'm testifying today for my World War II veteran dad, who I lost at age 95 last month. I'm the poster boy for this bill, as I've been red flagged since 1998, 25 years now by law enforcement in Minnetonka and Richfield and their prosecutors and judges for no just cause. This bill eviscerates your Second Amendment right to protect yourself and your family from exactly this kind of dangerous overreach by government. This massive, unprecedented expansion of police power our founders warned us about will result in disaster for law-abiding citizens of the state, especially those outside of the seven-county metro thug bubble. Your right to confront your accuser, stripped. Your right to a hearing to defend yourself before you get SWAT raided, that's stripped. This bill egregiously violates due process. I went to prison for a decade over a false rape allegation by state statute 609.347 subdivision 1. The testimony of the accuser need not be corroborated. If I can go to prison for rape for 10 years over a lie, you will have your firearms taken by law enforcement over any lie. Why are police in Minnesota getting more power? Democrats scream to defund the police.
Mr. Evanstead, please wrap up. One final sentence to wrap up.
Don't I have the same time Paul Schnell got? Instead of red flag...
Mr. Evanstead, we're going to move on to Ms.
Can I have my last sentence, you...
You just did by asking questions.
Okay, well, the most important part of this is there needs to be an MSOP for violent criminals. You're removing the gun, leaving the person there. So I'm going to take this time to talk about MSOP
you're not, Mr.
violent
Evanstead.
Criminals. Okay, very much.
You're done.
Thank you. Have a nice day.
Yep, you too. Ms. Niehoff.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Elena Niehoff. I'm a registered nurse from Rochester, Minnesota. I'm testifying in opposition to Bill HF 15. It is perfectly understandable that so many people want to do something to prevent future shootings, but the enactment of the Bill HF 15 is not an appropriate response. Good example is Connecticut. Connecticut passed the red flag bill in 1999, but it did not prevent 2012 Sandy Hook shooting. Florida. Florida had the Baker Act before mass shooting. Please do your research. I'm advocating to enforce existing laws instead of creating the new red flag laws. I also advocate to support the police instead of undermining the police authority. I want to explain why this bill supersedes the authority of the Constitution. The intent of this bill is to catch people before they actually commit the crime, based on presumption that individual may commit the crime in the future. It contradicts the notion innocent before proven guilty. Our judiciary system stands to impose punitive measures after illegal conduct has occurred, not in anticipation of that conduct. This bill may deprive innocent people of their rights. Please vote no on this bill. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And that wraps up testifiers. Is there anyone else from the public wishing to testify on this bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Doug Taylor, and I am a firearms instructor with my company, Hat Trick Training. I'd like to testify in opposition to this bill. And that term, Hat Trick Training, might have just flew by people in relationship to firearms training. The reason why I call my company Hat Trick Training is in remembrance to my son, who was a big-time hockey player from little kid through adulthood, but he was also a hunter and a shooter. And he died from suicide by gun coming up on 6 years on Memorial Day. So I know a thing or two about the impact of suicide to those who survive the suicide. And in my classes, I open every class with the story of my son and why this connection to the name of my company, so that I promote the idea of suicide awareness. And every class I end with the suicide awareness, the stats on how many suicides are by firearms and how we must take this seriously, because firearms are inherently dangerous tools. And when people use firearms, it succeeds. So I would be in opposition to this because of the fact that I look at our case with my son, and I never knew there was any suicidal tendencies until 6 a.m. when the Savage Police knocked on my door telling me that that he had died. So there's lots of anecdotal situations on the other side, pro side for the bill, but I want to put my anecdotal situation on the opposition because I look at this, would it have solved anything in our case? And it wouldn't. There are other ways to help people who are seriously suicidal, and I would like to pursue those instead of a red flag bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, and sorry for your loss.
Thanks.
Moving on to member discussion, Representative Weens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is for Director Sue Abderholden. Director, thank you to NAMI and many other mental health organizations that over past years have changed the stigma of seeking mental health for many of us. I represent the veteran community, and of course we're savaged by mental health issues. Not everyone is as energized and motivated, but it does impact my community. I'm a little concerned about this bill in the sense of it may send a chilling effect to those that are seeking mental health help. And my question is, would HF 15 really inhibit some people that need mental health from seeking mental health? And under early intervention, I think mental health therapy and professionals are probably the best early intervention. And I would want those people, whether they're veterans or they're citizens, to seek mental health and not be discouraged that they may lose one of their civil rights. Thank you.
Ms. Abderholden.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. We talked extensively about this within the Mental Health Legislative Network, and that's 40 organizations related to mental health, including psychiatrists, psychologists, et cetera. They all said that it isn't something that they would jump on, that they were doing a risk assessment for suicide. You know, it wouldn't be just someone has depression, right? It would have to be, really, they're very, very seriously concerned that that person is about to take their life. They all said that they would certainly talk about voluntary efforts first. We supported the bill that you could put yourself on a list voluntarily to not buy a gun for, a couple of months just to protect yourself against that. So they would do that first. So it would only be in kind of those extreme situations would they do that, because they do recognize the impact that it could have. So, again, nothing that they would do very easily. But they all felt that it was important at times, especially when someone perhaps is living alone, they don't have connections with family members and things like that. They would really want to protect that person.
Madam Chair, just
Representative Weens.
Yeah, could you briefly describe for a mental health care professional if the request for medical records, mental health records of a patient, how that would be processed, and if there's a difference between what's currently in law and what HF 15 does?
Ms. Abderholden.
Madam Chair, Representative, so the records, my understanding in reading the bill is that when they request any records, that the records themselves are private. We wanted to go a step further and say that the order is private, because we feel that that is a healthcare issue. They're not a danger to anyone else in the community. And we saw, especially in talking about Greater Minnesota, where people own more guns, that you wouldn't want someone to find out that you had your guns taken away because you were suicidal. So we wanted that to be private for that very reason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the work that you're doing to help people with mental illness and
Thank you.
All right. Representative Grossel.
Madam Chair and committee members and Representative Frazier.
I'll do a little bit.
Brace yourself. Here it comes. This is no laughing matter at all. I hear all the testimony, and it tears at your heart to have somebody lose a loved one to any violent crime, any suicide, all of it. It's horrible. But I look at the bill before, and I look at this, and they're just, again, we're going the wrong direction. If you're trying to solve a problem, and we on this side of the aisle have offered solutions, it's fallen on deaf ears thus far. Well, not all of them. So these are. I look at this, and you know the HF-14. I mean, it's getting damn close to gun registration. HF-15. This is a violation of due process with these ex parte orders, and it just smacks of people's rights being quashed or oppressed, and that is not what we're here to do. That's not our job here. This red flag bill has had little to no effect in states that have implemented this. And you can go to the CDC, just go to the CDC and look at their charts, and you can see it for yourself. You can see it for yourself that the crimes and suicides, I mean, they still continue to climb. These don't work. Not to mention that they put law enforcement in harm's way unnecessarily with these ex parte orders, where they're going to somebody's house and they're having to seize people. You know, the weapons are there. They're going to seize weapons. Now, I'm not gonna paint mental illness the way it's been painted thus far, and that is, you know, these people are dangerous. You know, and that's, we got to get away from, we got to quit doing that.
I think explicitly that has not been stated.
It's been the opposite, actually.
Yeah, that's, Commissioner Schnell testified to the opposite.
And, you know, when the sheriff comes to someone's home and takes their guns, Representative, what do they do with the person in crisis? I mean, what happens with them? Because there's nothing in the bill that says. What do they do with the person in crisis?
Vice Chair Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Grosso, we do have other resources that are currently available that there are mental health networks, there are crisis mobile teams that exist, and in all 87 counties, we can access those. Those are currently available, and I do believe we need to do more. But in this situation, this is, as I in my opening statement said, this is a bit of a cooling off period. This is the moment to remove something that could be of great harm to that individual or to others, and to allow that cooling off period, allow there to be help provided. So that there is not harm done. That is the purpose of this. And you spoke earlier in regards to how we're not addressing the issue. When you have a number that says 76% of deaths are by firearms and part of that are suicides, I think this is exactly getting at the issue. This is designed exactly to address the issue. And in the states that have these in place, they have seen an impact that has been positive when you've seen the number of deaths that are by gun or firearms suicide going down. If it's 1%, 2%, 3%, 4%, 5%, up to 7% or 8%, that is impactful. Those are individual family members that they're going to see the next day. Those kids are going to come home and see their dad, or they're going to see their granddad, they're going to see their aunt, they're going to see their mom. That's impactful. And I can't stand for and agree with that. That's not impactful.
Follow up, Representative Grossel.
Madam Chair, and in the same information from the CDC, you know, any reduction in firearm suicide was both offset by other means of suicide. So you take the gun out of the equation, there's other means. And the information from the CDC shows it. So, you know, look that up. We have all the laws on the books already to address all of these crimes, to address violent crimes. The criminal justice system has to do its job. We have to arrest these people, build the cases, arrest them, get them prosecuted, get them sentenced. We have the means to do it. We have the means to have a 72-hour hold, get people the counseling and that's needed and the help they need. So why we're going after, again, we're going the wrong direction here. We're leaning in the direction of oppressing people's Second Amendment rights. You're creating a problem instead of bringing a solution. And I know my colleagues from the former law enforcement people that testified. They don't speak for rural Minnesota sheriffs and chiefs. I can guarantee you that. I stay in touch with my people out there. They don't speak for them because these are unconstitutional. And I'll tell you what. You folks better start waking up on this stuff. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Grassley, that was not a threat. And I think to the point I think you were trying to make earlier, this isn't about criminal activity. And I want to be careful that none of us are talking about criminalizing folks who are struggling with mental illness and possible self-harm. Vice Chair Frazier.
Madam Chair, thank you. I did want to address that. You had, again, in your comments, well, initially you said we shouldn't criminalize or say that folks that are dealing with mental health crisis are violent. I agree, but then you went on to say that we need to arrest and use the laws to deal with violent people. This law is designed to deal and to help individuals that may be having mental health crisis, not to criminalize it, but to take the instrument away that could cause the most lethal harm. We've heard testimony from a mental health professional that said it's not always or not commonly the case that the individual will seek for another way to commit suicide once one item is taken away. I believe the professionals. So I believe when they say that, and this is a tool to, again, allow for that cooling off period and allow for help to be put in place so that an individual could get to a better place.
Thank you. Madam Chair, if I may address the I don't threaten people. I've never threatened people in committee or
okay,
or
well,
my
when
colleagues.
When and I know some of the testifiers did this too, but we do have to be careful that when we say, well, you better watch out, or you know,
I said
careful.
To wake up, Madam Chair.
I okay, great. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Becker Fenn. Thank you, Representative Frazier, for bringing this bill. I will do my best to keep this short. One of the heartbreaking parts about being a person in this country is that all of our communities have their own special relationship to gun violence. As we heard from testifiers on both sides of this, these gun deaths are very close to very many of us. And it's not an easy conversation to have. And I find extreme protection orders very, very complicated to support. I do believe that we should avoid involuntary holds at all times. I do believe we should limit the number of times that a law enforcement official knocks on the door to take away people's property. I think those are very hard things to support. I also know that my community, the trans community, has a very close relationship to the issue that we're talking about. The murder of trans people by gun is statistically much higher, and I'm not going to share all the data because I will cry if I do, but my community is dying by gun violence, mostly domestic murder. They're dying by suicide, 70% of which are by firearm. And we have to find ways to solve that problem. And this is a way that's being brought forth that says we're trying to address that problem. It's not a perfect solution. It's not going to save every trans person from murder. We know that. It's not going to stop every trans person from committing suicide. We know that. But I think that we can stop acting like a few lives saved isn't worthy of our work. A small percentage of people who are not killed is a reason to take action on guns. I have multiple people in my life who should be alive and are not because somebody couldn't get their guns away from them. One of them ended up being killed by police. One of them ended up being killed taking their own life. So I want to thank you for bringing this bill. I'm urging people to support the bill. I'm recognizing that this bill has extremely complicated relationship to lived experience of people, but we are here to make really hard choices and not pretend like one way or the other way is the obvious easy way. So we should stop acting like that. We should stop scaring people. We should try to help people. So I have a question for Representative Frazier. Is this the best thing that we can do right now to try to help people?
Vice Chair Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Finke, for sharing those words and your personal experiences. I believe this is one of the tools, one of the best things we can do right now to do this. There are other bills moving through the legislature that I believe will be helpful as well, but this is one of those tools that I think is needed.
Thank you. Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Frazier. I have a couple of questions specifically on Section 8 on page 13, if you can direct your attention to that. Section 8 creates an offense or offenses for, in particular, false information or harassment. When we're talking about the court process that we're creating, it creates an offense. The person who petitions for an extreme risk protection order, and then it says, knowing any information in the petition to be materially false or with the intent to harass, abuse, or threaten is guilty of a misdemeanor. And that strikes me as quite a serious crime, both against the court process we're talking about and against a particular person's constitutional rights, and I'm curious as to why that's only a misdemeanor in the bill.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We thought that it being a misdemeanor would be sufficient to deter that type of behavior.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Frazier. Can you explain a little bit further why it's a misdemeanor here and in other places in the, for example, in the current law, a person who makes a false statement in order to obtain a transferee permit is guilty of a gross misdemeanor. House File 14, which your co-author on, tries to raise that to a felony. I'm curious as to the policy reasons for why we would define that as such a low offense.
Vice Chair Frazier.
I think I would say ask and answer, Representative Niski.
We do like to play court in here sometimes. That's why people don't like to talk through me, because I get to slow you down. Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Frazier. I also am curious about the beginning part of that, that it's limited to a person who petitions. Is that just the person who actually files a petition, or would that include, for example, in the ex parte emergency context, someone who goes to law enforcement, gives law enforcement false information with the intent to harass or to knowing that information is false. Would that person also be potentially chargeable under this new false information or harassment provision?
Vice Chair Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This would address direct petitioners, but I would say, if in going through the process, if a judge determines that an individual that is a part of that process providing information does so knowingly in a false situation, I believe they would be able to address that.
Yeah, I mean, it's already a crime to falsely report to law enforcement. Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that was my question: would we need to go to the false police report statute or something like that? Do you have? I mean,
this would not.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Sorry, Madam Chair. Representative Niska. This would not prevent the law enforcement or the courts from using the laws that are already on the books.
Right. Thank you.
Further, Representative Niska.
Yes, I do have. I did also want to ask Representative Frazier about the same topic that I had asked Representative Pinto about, and in particular the ACLU letter. Once we pass this law, and I'm thinking about this in the context of the emergency ex parte process where it's most likely going to be, I think, law enforcement going to a judge potentially late at night. Is there going to be some way for us to understand in particular the, and maybe through de-identified data or something, the ways in which that impacts particular communities or, you know, just to get at the concern? And I know that you share the same concern that the ACLU is expressing, and just how are we going to know whether the ACLU's concern bears itself out in reality and is something that maybe we should be concerned about in the future, changing or something like that? Is there any...
Representative Niska, I think you've asked something that sounded like a question like five times, and I think we know what you're getting at. Yeah. So Vice Chair Frazier.
Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Niska, I do share that concern broadly overall in our criminal justice system. What I can tell you the most that I like hearing is that you are passionately making inquiries about that and seem to share that concern. There will be a bill looking to collect data from our courts, and that's one of the things that we can make sure we address to take a look at. We know there's disparities. We know there's inequities. But to look specifically, see where they are to help us guide our policy. So I hope you're going to join me on that bill.
Representative Niska, I need to move to Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, I see he's
got a list there, too.
Representative Niska. I just want to tell Representative Frazier, come talk to me about that.
Appreciate it.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Beckerton, Representative Frazier, I understand what you're doing with this bill. What we've seen across this country, they don't work that well. California's got probably some of the strictest gun laws in the country, including red flag laws, had two mass shootings just in the last month. It doesn't seem to work. Now, I understand your goal in this is to get the person help, or actually get the firearms out of there to think of safe, to make the situation safe, but does nothing to get the person the help that they need. And the other thing just going through both House File 14 and 15 while I'm sitting here listening. This is a great 1-2 punch to dismantle our Second Amendment. Get an extreme risk order against you, and guess what? By House File 14, it can be used to prevent you from obtaining a firearm and using your Second Amendment rights. Now, I'm going to just be real quick here. I'm sure Chair Beckerfin, you're going to be surprised about that. But I want to end with one quote from one of our founding fathers, Benjamin Franklin. Those who would give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserves neither liberty or safety.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, it's been stated that these laws don't work. And the data actually comes from the CDC that shows that the 19 states with red flag laws, the suicide rate continued to climb in every state except Nevada, which enacted its red flag law in 2019. And the suicide rate there had already been declining. So it's really, you know, we don't make all of our laws here based on data, but it does inform our decision-making and our policy-making. So I think it's really important to understand that it has not helped. Red flag laws have not decreased suicide in those states that have adopted them. And so has the number of people that commit suicide by gun gone down? Perhaps, but they've found other ways. I had the misfortune of, in the last month, knowing two people in their early 20s that hung themselves. So I do know that people with ideation, if there's no intervention, are going to find a way to carry out, unfortunately, taking of their own lives, and it's heartbreaking. Representative Frazier, I do have a couple of questions. When the sheriff comes to someone's home and takes their firearms, what are they doing with that person in crisis under your bill?
Vice Chair Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Scott, I did address this in an earlier question, but I'll say it again. There is nothing that prevents other services from being called in to support this individual. There are crisis mobile teams in all 87 counties that can be engaged to help with those, to help in those situations. This does not address everything. I agree with that. And then to your data points earlier, you're citing overall suicide rates. We're specifically talking about it has an impact on suicides by firearms. And that there is an impact there. And it has shown the rates to decrease in states that have these laws in place. So I just want to make sure we're clear about desegregating that data and not just saying overall suicide rates. But there's nothing that prevents sheriffs from showing up and engaging with other mental health professionals to get that individual the help that they need, or working with their families to do that as well. This is only there to help take away one of the most lethal tools that we know are being used in suicides.
Representative Scott, and we've got just a couple more minutes before the next committee needs to be in this room.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Frazier, you're missing the point of the statistic. Overall suicide rates have not gone down, even if the gun violence ones have, the ones that are taking their own lives by guns. And I know you're impatient with me and you're rolling your eyes, but the fact is, if we're trying to keep people from committing suicide, this is not helping, because if they don't use a firearm, they're finding other means. Representative Frazier, how would law enforcement know that they've confiscated all the firearms in the home?
Vice Chair Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. They will, if the warrant or the order will describe the firearm, then that's the firearms that have been identified in the petition. Those are the firearms that they will be there to remove. And I will say this, there is an opportunity in the order for the individual to self-transfer. It doesn't have to be the sheriff going into the individual's property. They can self-transfer. They can bring the firearm in themselves to law enforcement or to an arms dealer to have the transfer done. So you don't necessarily have to have law enforcement into someone's property to take away. And in some states, we have seen where, in most cases, the individual will make the self-transfer, and you don't have to have law enforcement come in to take it away.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Final question. What happens if the law enforcement agency refuses to return a person's firearms after the order has expired? What is their cause of action there?
Vice Chair Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Scott. The law requires law enforcement to return the firearm. The individual would have the ability to petition through the court to make sure their firearm is returned if that is not the case.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Vice Chair Frazier, closing comments, and I'm assuming you guys want a roll call on this? Okay, roll call having been requested. Vice Chair Frazier, closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is one more tool to help us to address an issue that we know is substantial, and particularly in greater Minnesota. It's having a huge impact on Minnesotans. And whenever we find a way, and we know that the data tells us that this is a solution to a problem, it is our duty as lawmakers and policymakers to implement something, to provide a solution and put the solution in place. I don't get frustrated by the debate, but I do get frustrated when the opposition arguments are just repeated as a way to make them a fact. It doesn't make it a fact because you repeat it multiple times. The data is what we're going by. It's what's driving us to put these things in place. And that is what I listen to. When I listen to the professionals that came and testified, and that's what we should do. Those are the folks we should listen to. We should be driven by the data, and I believe we can put things in place to help save lives. Thank you.
Thank you. Vice Chair Frazier renews his motion that House File 15, as amended, is referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker Finn.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Aye.
Minority Leader Scott.
No.
Representative Carroll.
Aye.
Representative Curran.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Finke.
Aye.
Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Representative Grossel.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Moeller.
Excused.
Representative Niska.
No.
Representative Weens?
No.
Seven ayes, five nays.
With seven ayes and five nays, the motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to Ways and Means. We are adjourned.